Succession number 27083, reel 19.
Oh, 20 seconds.
I well knew that
it was traditional for the parade training officer at Whale Island this year to be the field gun officer for the Portsmouth crew at Olympia, as it then was, later to be Earl's Court, the next year. And I regarded this as inevitable. But just in case I had a let out, I considered it, and I considered it very carefully, because I'd been 18 months on course in round figures, 18 months on the junior staff, in both cases ashore. I was a seaman officer, one way or another, a bit before and a bit winding up the records afterwards. I wouldn't see much out of a further 18 months if I did the field gun. And I thought, quite honestly, that this was unprofessional, and it was time I freshened a nip and went to sea. Well, I was sent for by the same training commander, who was a good personal friend, who did not play it at all cleverly, but then he wasn't a clever man. And instead of saying, "I want you to do the field gun next year," which is what I was expecting, he said, "How would you like to do the field gun next year?" Which you could say was very nice of him. But I by then made my mind up that I didn't want to touch it. And so I said, straight answer to a straight question, "Sir, I'd rather not. I think it's time I went to sea." And he was furious. End of a beautiful friendship. And he flung me out of his office. And all he had to do was to say, "You bloody do the field gun and get on with it." And that would have been that. But he didn't. And they went round, he went round, I forget how many now, three or four other, which was about the rest of the junior staff. And they each made an excuse. Could I wait until after the weekend and have a chance to discuss it with my wife and or whatever? Or they said no. And they all said no. And eventually they had to get, again, one of my long course, transferred from Chatham to take the Portsmouth field gun's crew. At which point, and this is a bit later on, I was sent for by the training commander, who started by saying, "Good morning, Henry," and all that jovial stuff. And then went on and said, "Now, since you didn't want to do the field gun," pause for effect, "minesweepers." And my heart sank. I didn't know anything about minesweepers. As far as I was concerned, they probably had nothing to do with gunnery at all. And I wasn't far wrong. He then went on to give me a 15-minute build-up as to how all my contemporaries would go as second gunnery officer to a destroyer or frigate squadron, but I should go as the gunnery officer to a minesweeping squadron. Flotillas, they were called then. Well, I went round to the experimental department and looked up the book of all the details of ships and so forth, and my worst fears were realized. There was something which was only just improved on a muzzle loader and so forth. And that was the only gunnery they had. No fire control whatsoever. And in due course, I went home for my next weekend and explained to my mother what the future held for me. And she was furious. And she glared at me and said, "You are a fool," and so on. And this needled me a lot and so on. And suffice it to say that I began to have doubts myself. And Mum had said, "You know, there you are, and instead of going to Olympia, where you'll be in the public eye, and everybody will know you, you go to go off to God knows where, one of these little, dirty, hard-drinking ships, and all that sort of stuff, you see. And I had an acute feeling that she was not terribly far wrong on all this. But I placed my bets, and I had to stand by it. And I therefore steeled myself, and I really did steel myself for the worst. And we'll stop there because it's a good break before I went out to the med. So there I was, committed to going out to joining the 2nd Minesweeping Flotilla, stationed in the Mediterranean, based on Malta, and I'll come to that more later, and generally still engaged in quite heavy operational sweeping of actual mines, mainly up in the Aegean. And I went out to Malta by troop ship, and I embarked in the destroyer Ain, which took me up to Aegean waters, where I transferred to a Danlair, which was an Isles-class trawler, but fitted for Danlaying and so forth. Very small, pretty uncomfortable. The weather was poor. It was blowing a gale. They had filthy food to feed you with. And I felt seasick. And we reached the anchorage where the flotilla was at about 2100. The pattern I will describe in a moment. But I arrived on board in the motor cutter sent across by the leader, Fierce, which was to be my home for the next 18 months or so. And coming alongside, the coxswain of the boat didn't get it, didn't handle it very well, but we got there eventually. And on the sweep deck aft, by the where the ladder was, the duty officer, who I recognized as being the flotilla communications officer, and he'd been a couple of terms or so up on me at Dartmouth, and I was rather surprised to see him in pretty scruffy plain clothes, very scruffy in fact, and he appeared to be rather staggering about. And he picked up a heaving line and sort of more or less coiled it in his hands, not very well, and he flung it at the barman of the boat, but he let go of both ends, and that wasn't really very effective. Well, I jumped for the gangway, for the ladder, and clambered on board and met him. His name was Peter Page. And this was on the sweep deck, and I clambered the ladder onto the next deck up, where I met my predecessor, who was the squadron gunnery officer. In case I confused you by sometimes talking of flotilla and sometimes squadron, the term flotilla, i.e. a group of destroyers or frigates or minesweepers, was on its way out. It was still just in use, but the term squadron was then put in place instead of it. And a flotilla then became a number of squadrons. So I'll talk about squadron in terms of one's immediate 6 or 8 ships, as they usually were. At that time. Well, there was my predecessor, whose name was Bison Turner. Bison, because he had a head looking exactly like a bison. Charming man, who I'd known before. He was the long course before mine, so there was the 18 months difference pattern between us and so forth. And he was, again, slightly to my surprise, he was very smartly dressed, but in yachting rig. And he had a sort of battle dress thing on in dark blue, and he wasn't wearing a cap. And he greeted me, and as we shook hands, I was aware of a not just an aroma, but you might say a stench of whiskey. And my mother's words, "hard drinking little ships," were running through my mind at the time. Anyway, he greeted me, and with only a slightly faltering step, took me forward and down the hatch and into the wardroom. And the scene in the wardroom was unusual. It was quite a small wardroom, and it had, you went in through the door, and on the right-hand side, which was actually the forward part of the mess, was a long sideboard affair. And then there was the single long table athwartships with various chairs at it. And then there was a U-shaped bank of settees, really, in the center of which, at the extreme after end, was an electric fire. So that was the layout. And the scene that met my eyes was starting with the table. The table was laid with a sheet, not a tablecloth, but a sheet. And it had somebody's name in loud letters in one corner. And seated at it were, on one side, the only ship's officer, who was a man called Bill Fitzherbert, a young lieutenant, who I knew slightly. He was busy gobbling his food. This, bear in mind, was 9 o'clock at night or so. Gobbling his food, shoveling in his mouth, and he just looked up and said, "Hi, sorry, got to go on watch." And I could only suppose it must mean anchor watch because of the state of the weather. At the other end, another side of the table, was the engineer officer, a man called James, very dour, and he was dressed in a filthy pair of overalls. And by his side, where you would normally have expected his glass of water to be, or whatever, was his cap, with an almost brown, ever so dirty, cap cover, and his gloves, and his torch, the insignia of his trade, if you like. And in the center of the table was a bowl containing what was practically liquid corned beef, because it had disintegrated. And he was endeavouring to transport elements of the bowl of corned beef not onto his plate, but direct into his mouth with a soup spoon. And he wasn't making a very good fist of it. And I can't remember what he said, but he sort of slurred something out, and that was it. On the far... this was on the port side settee, the far side, other side of the club fender, was the squadron navigating officer, Derek Ford, who was out, just out for the count. He was covered with a couple of duffel coats. He was snoring his head off, and in a sort of way that one can tell, he was snoring, really, because he was blind drunk. And again, my mother's words floated through my mind. Well, my predecessor sat himself on the club fender, and I sat in an armchair, as close as I am to you, just opposite, and I was offered a glass of whiskey, which I gladly accepted, and which I rather needed by this time. And that was fine, and we talked about nothing in particular. And we had a second glass of whiskey. And then my predecessor said, well, I think it's about time we went and washed and dressed for dinner, which surprised me in view of the time and so forth. But, and perhaps I should make it clear now, the sort of routine that one worked in those ships when you were on the job sweeping was that you turned to at 5:30 or 6 in the morning and you sailed from whatever little local shelter, not necessarily anchorage, you spent a few hours the previous night, and you swept hard throughout the whole day. And you returned to some anchorage at about 2100 that night. And this routine went on for a couple of months at a time. And it was quite hard work. Indeed, it was very hard work. But then you returned to Malta, where we were based, and then you had a month off, and you could play games and freshen up and generally restore order to both men and machines, and so on. So this was not unusual that they just got into anchor because they were in the middle of a sweeping thing, operation. and he said, it's about time he went and washed and changed for dinner. And I, of course, hadn't got my gear unpacked or anything like that, so I said, would I be all right in a... if I slip on a bow tie with my ordinary day monkey jacket? Oh, yes, I said, of course. And I was shown my cabin, which I shared with the squadron torpedo anti-submarine officer, who previously had had the cabin to himself. And because my predecessor was still on board, of course, we had to double up a bit. And he didn't take kindly to that. And he thought this was the end of the world for him. Why the hell should I go to his cabin? And the reason I went was because it was a bigger cabin than most of the others, and so on. So that got us away, or not exactly, in the best possible footing.
Just to give one an idea of the officers' quarters, how big is a big cabin? In feet.
About the size... about twice the size of the loo here.
Right.
I.e. pretty small.
Extremely small.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, there we were. 15 minutes later, when I went back into the wardroom, there they all were, in mess undress, in immaculate order, nobody reeling, nobody stinking of whiskey any longer. And the whole thing was a put-up job, including the squadron navigating officer, who had not been out for reasons of booze. In fact, he hadn't been out at all, and so on. And the sequel to that was that, I'll come on to the captain later, but he was very keen on his tennis and his squash, and I was quite keen on both, and I used to play a lot with him. And quite early on, when eventually we got back to Malta, he invited me to join his party up at the Maza to play tennis. And between sets, I sat next to some quite attractive, but rather stuck up, rather snooty young girl. And he was a great one for the girls, and would go to endless lengths to... again, I will come to that a bit more later on. And she regaled me with a somewhat enlarged account. Had I heard about the officer who had joined some ship in some squadron, and she recounted all this sort of thing, some of it was grossly exaggerated, some of it was distorted, and so forth. And by this time, I'd lost patience, and I was by no means attracted to this girl. And so I looked at her coldly and said, I was the officer, and you got it all wrong. But the important thing was that the captain of the ship, who was the captain, Captain Minesweepers, captain of the squadron, and a very senior four-stripe captain, he didn't know that it had gone on at all. So that was quite interesting. Well, that's my arrival on board. We were the leader. There was just this one officer who was a ship staff only, and the rest of us all had a squadron duty, but we acted as ship's officers as well. we had Captain MS, MS-2 it was, second mine to flotilla. He was a signalman. He was a huge man, good 6'4", very handsome, plenty of lovely silvery hair, God's gift to women, and he knew it, and he played on it. And he was a great one for the girls. He was a super person, but it took me a little time to come to terms with him, as it were. Once you had come to terms with him, then you were on a very good basis, and I won't say you could do nothing wrong, but once he had got confidence in you, he played you accordingly and expected anything of you. But he was a fine man. The first lieutenant, who was not squadron staff, but he was the ship's officer, was a lieutenant commander, a nice man, doing his first job, I think, as a first lieutenant. And in the eyes of some of the staff, the squadron staff, didn't always get it quite right. I found no problem with him, really, at all. He was a nice man called Mark Carr, and his son, to whom I will return later, his son is today the Naval Secretary, and prior to that, he was the captain of Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth. Very nice man. I think that's probably enough to sketch the officers. Very soon after I joined, we packed up sweeping, and we went on an operational visit to Izmir in Turkey, where, as was more or less par for the course out there, we secured stern to the wall. That was pretty well standard practice in the smaller Mediterranean ports. The first night in, the locals gave a reception in the local yacht club at, I think it was 1700 or so. And I remember this for it being a slightly unusual night and a singularly stuffy one. All these good ladies who were of mature, ripe years were, I'm sure, the cream of the local aristocracy. And they were all sitting around, looking a bit lonely, and on the whole, incapable of speaking a word of English. And they had a band, and there were chaps dressed as stewards that were serving out the grog and that sort of thing. And my predecessor he had quite an eye for the girls too, and he was, amongst other things, he's a very nice man, and of course I'd known him quite well from days back in Wedding, and amongst other things, he was a really very, very good dancer. And the only person who spoke fluent English present for this reception thing was the wife of the local English doctor. And she was a big woman. She was very good looking. I suppose she was then about in her mid-40s or so. And in the course of the evening, one became aware, and of course one had to split up and go and talk to the locals, and it was quite hard going. And in the course of the evening, one realized that, not particularly surprisingly, my predecessor had got off with this doctor's wife. And they had several dances together. And he spoke very quietly, and he was a great tease. And he, it was towards the end of a dance, and just as it ended and the band stopped playing, he made some remark to her, which I never heard, and which obviously he'd gone a couple of steps too far. And just as the band stopped playing, he made this remark. She took offense, and she stood back and gave him a stinging slap over the face, which rang like a pistol shot through this not very large room. Well, he recoiled from this, and she started to stomp off. And then the band struck up, and without any hesitation at all, my predecessor swept up to her, threw his arms around her, and said, "Shall we dance?" And he got away with it, of course, because he was that sort of guy. Well, on the Sunday, I was a duty officer, and by this time, my captain, whose name was Keith Campbell Walter, and he was the father of, what was her name? She became very famous as a society girl. Fiona, was it? Fiona Campbell Walter? At the time, he was just Keith Walter, then he tacked on the Campbell later on. Anyway, he had got on to this doctor's wife and invited her on board for lunch with him, alone, just the two of them, in his cabin. And so it fell to me to meet them on the brow, leading over the stern, onto the jetty, and so forth. And of course the captain was down there to meet her, and away they went. And that's all I heard of that side of things for quite some time. And then around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the captain's steward came to me and said that the captain's guest was about to leave the ship. So of course I went aft to the sweep deck to see her off. And it must have been in the spring, I think, late spring, but it was quite chilly. And the gangway staff were wearing watch coats. I wasn't. It was a lovely day and sunny, but it was a sort of clear frosty day. And in due course, aft came the captain with this doctor's wife. Chatting away, 19 to the dozen, and they'd obviously had got a good lunch, and they were on very good terms. And they went down the ladder to the sweep deck, and the way out onto the jetty then meant that you, having got to the sweep deck, you had to go up a very short flight of about 3 temporary wooden steps onto a few planks across the sweep gear, and that took you to the brow, which went out directly astern onto the jetty. And she had put on her huge, all-enveloping mink coat, because it was a chilly day. And as she reached the 3 steps up, she turned and said, "Thank you so much, Captain Walter," and she went on, and rather gushingly, like this, meantime stepping backwards, got onto the platform, went on stepping backwards, still saying, "So kind of you, Captain Walter." I went a bit too far, and went over the edge of the platform, and over the guardrails, because it was level with the top of that, straight into the harbour. And the harbour at that point, Izmir, was a dirty sort of grey-black colour with rats and a dead sheep and garbage and God knows what there. and in she went. Whereupon the quartermaster, who was an able seaman, very brave, I wasn't going to make a move for this because I've told you about my swimming earlier, but the quartermaster was much more gallant than I, and he stripped off his watch coat and dived after her over the side. And one was then given the remarkable spectacle that the quartermaster could hardly swim at all, whereas the doctor's wife was clearly a very powerful swimmer, and she got the quartermaster's head in the approved position. By this time she was on her back, more or less between her legs, and she was towing, paddling the quartermaster, who was a bit beyond it by then, to the steps on the jetty, which she reached, and that was fine, and she helped the quartermaster up the steps, not the other way around, and the quartermaster was sort of breathless with rats and muckage and general exhaustion at the top. And there was the doctor's wife's car, which was a Rolls Royce with a chauffeur. I can't remember the colour of it, but I remember the upholstery was a sort of pale beige colour. And there was the chauffeur holding the door open. And she turned again to wave a hand. All the muck and stuff